Harry's.com. It's nice to be with a Harry's man.
Harry's.com/TRN. Let me tell you a story about Jeff and Andy. These guys were just fed up with the expense of shaving, and they thought, we can do better. All a razor is good quality blades. So they went out, they bought the factory, and now they make good quality razors at a fair price.
I like this story. Will you just go out and buy something when you're fed up with things?
And make it better. And that's what I like about Jeff and Andy. They made it better. And the best thing about it is I love the razor blades because they're super sharp. Since I've started using Harry's, which was what? How long have we been using Harry's?
A long time.
Four years, five years?
You're a full-bearded man, Scott. You don't mess around. I'm quite impressed with how much hair you can punch out of your face.
And I can shave it off just as easily.
Harry's has a special deal right now. You can get all kinds of stuff. Scott, what do you get?
You get the trial set for free. All you do is pay for postage. And what you get is the weighted handle, the blades, which is what makes Harry's, right? And then you also get the shave cream. And you get that for free. All you do is pay for the shipping.
Simply go to harrysrazors.com/TRN. 25% RX bars. Are you kidding, Scott? RX bars are fantastic.
RXBar.com/TRN. Use the code TRN when you check out, and you can get 25% off.
They're my favorite flavor, easily sea salt maple. I'm still excited about it when a full case shows up, and it doesn't take long for them to go, and I'm sure that others are taking them. I can't be eating all of those.
You know, it's nice to have something at your side or something in your pocket that you know is good for you, and that's what these are. They have no junk in them that most of the bars out there have, and they're tasty.
Not only good for the trail, not only post-workout, pre-workout, but just during the day when you need to reach in and grab some.
Yep. Go to rxbar.com/TRN, and don't forget to use the code TRN when you check out.
25% off.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of the worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast, with me, a complete imposter here in London, England, and your two real hosts over there with a skeleton behind them very early morning in the studio. It's Scott and Dom.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of, like, old brothel hookers, like, buried out here.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
Okay, we'll clear that up. That will the group of the nation and podcast downloaders are very sophisticated.
They are.
They're unlike any other group out there. They're tolerant. They ignore our many imperfections, and they'll be able to substitute the word. No problem.
They will.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
And my name is Scott War. And today we are joined with the founder of McMillan Running Company. His name is actually McMillan, Greg McMillan. He's been on the podcast before. Hey, Greg, how are you doing?
Great.
He actually has a great website with a lot of great content. If you've never been to McMillanRunning.com, you should go check it out. There's a lot of cool calculators there. There's his staff of running coaches is very diverse that you can choose from there. Greg personally has a master's degree in exercise science, and he's a national trail marathon master. I don't know if you know.
Well, that qualifies him, absolutely.
So he knows how to run, and he knows how to coach. So thank you for joining us, Greg.
Sure.
We want to start this thing off. One of the things that is common talk in ultra running, but I don't know whether a lot of us understand it, me included, is VO2 max. Can you explain VO2 max and why do we need it? Is it important? Do I need to know what it is?
So VO2 max is your maximum amount of oxygen that you can consume. And people see this all the time. What's your VO2 max? Higher VO2 max being better. In general, most training that distance runners do improves your VO2 max. Just regular going out for easy runs can improve your VO2 max. Specific training where you're actually challenging your VO2 max really improves VO2 max. And that's why I think a lot of trail runners, they kind of get it on the one side with a lot of easy running and the bulk of mileage, but sometimes they kind of avoid the heavy breathing stuff, things that we used to do going to the track and doing speed workouts. We sort of stopped doing that as trail runners. But if you think about the majority of trail races that you do, it involves some segment of significant heavy breathing. I live at 7,000 feet. When you race on the trails here, any incline will get your breathing very, very heavy. So I think for trail runners, an opportunity to focus on building their VO2 max, their sort of heavy breathing running, is a great opportunity to improve their race performances. Now, like I said, you can go to the track, sort of traditional track workouts, 400 meters, 800 meters, mile repeats, those types of workouts. But as a trail runner, you can actually do it anywhere, right? You can go to the trails, you can find a section where either you can run quickly to get that heavy breathing stimulus, or you can find a challenging section of the trail. Maybe it's a long climb where you've got to climb for 5 or 10 minutes. That's a great opportunity to push the pace, really challenge that VO2 max. Breathe heavy. You want to get used to heavy breathing, because at some point in your race, you're probably going to have to breathe heavy. And that shouldn't be a shock to the system. That should be like, okay, I understand how this is. I know how to distribute my effort when I'm breathing this heavily. Because a lot of times I see runners, they start to breathe heavy and they back off and they slow down. And they don't really have to do that. They need to push through that segment of the race. You know, breathe heavy, get through it, and then usually there's some recovery coming later. So for me, when I'm working with trail runners, I'm not abandoning the idea that you need some faster running, you need some heavy breathing workouts, because I know that that'll help them in their racing.
Let's define the heavy breathing, because we talk heart rate a lot of times, and everybody's different. Scott across the table from me has a heart that pumps faster, even though we're breathing the same. And we often compare heart rate, and since mine's lower, I like to kind of boast on that a little bit. Yep. But I know it's not true, because he's in great shape. But how much heavy breathing? How long, and what should it feel like for us as runners out there?
So if you think about breathing rate with your steps, so a lot of people, when they're doing sort of a lactate threshold or a tempo run, they're sort of a 2-2 breathing pattern. So it would be in, in, out, out. That would be a breathing pattern that would indicate the lactate threshold. So in, in, out, out, in, in, out, out. When you go faster than that, when you're breathing more in on one, out on one, in on one, out on two, something like that, that moves into what I would consider heavy breathing and more VO2 max. So lactate threshold, that 2-2 rhythm, that's very rhythmic. And people kind of feel like they're under control when they're breathing that 2-2 rhythm, kind of like in a tempo run. But when they start to breathe faster than that, that's where you get a little bit of the, oh boy, how long can I keep doing this? This is getting really challenging. I am not enjoying this quite as much as I was. That's when you know you're in that heavy breathing zone. And it would be great if you had exposures of 2 to 5 minutes in that zone. And you can do it as repetitions, right? So you could do a 400 meter repeat in 2 minutes, or you could do 1 mile continuous. You can break it up in different ways. But it's great if you can have about 2 to 5 minutes of that heavy breathing and then repeat that, you know, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 times. That's a great way to stimulate the VO2 max and the heavy breathing. Again, you'll get the physiological results that you want of a boost in fitness, but maybe most importantly, you get the psychological exposure. So when you get in those races, you start to breathe heavy. You're like, I've been here, done that. I know I have this in me. I know I can challenge myself. And you know how racing is on the trails. Sometimes if you're just a little bit better in certain segments of the race, you can run a lot better. You can run a lot faster, and you can improve your place in races.
I like that. 2 to 5 minutes, and you do it, you know, 3 to 5 times per workout, wherever you're feeling at the time. But how many times per week? Is that once per week? And I really appreciate you, you know, addressing this with us, because I want to do some of this. So is it weekly, or is it every workout? What do you subscribe?
or prescribed?
Well, certainly not every workout. I would say you could take a block of time, maybe 4 to 6 weeks, and you say once per week, I'm going to do a heavy breathing workout. Do that for 4 to 6 weeks and then go to a different type of training and then see the results that you get. And then you can come back to it. You wouldn't want to do it every week for a long time. That system gets fatigued fairly quickly. So if you did 8 straight weeks, you're going to see a very quick plateau in your performance and usually sort of getting a little bit stale. So I like to sprinkle it in along, cross training plans, or have a little block of time where you say, I'm going to specifically get ready for this race, for example, that I know is going to have a heavy breathing segment, and I'll do a short block of training for that. But I think once a week for most runners works out perfectly.
And that was my next question is, my big A race is coming up. How long should I, do this or lay off this VO2 max training before my big day?
Well, I definitely wouldn't do it within a couple of weeks of the race, particularly if it's not something you've been doing. You might want to sprinkle it in every other week, see a feel. Because one of the things, if you're adding something new, you want to see how your body responds to it. So you wouldn't want to all of a sudden do a lot of it, feel really fatigued for your race because it took more out of you than you were expecting. So you would preferably kind of start it earlier in your plan, get some exposure to it, and then you would know, okay, how many workouts do I need to where I'm feeling really sharp and race ready?
And you're the coach, and I don't want to sit here and do any coaching because that's your job. But anytime you start something new, you've got to kind of lean into it, not go all out like a veteran has done it many different cycles. So anything new on the trail for us or different should be with caution.
Yeah, and small doses to begin, baby steps, right?
Yeah.
Just do a little bit and then be aware of how you feel over the next few days. And then you can make your adjustments based on how your body and mind is responding.
So tell us how important that actual number is. I mean, and how do we come up with a VO2 max? I know there's some devices out there. I have a watch that does calculate a VO2 max. I'm not sure how accurate that is. And I probably looked at it twice since I've had the watch. I mean, should we be looking at that? And as we do these workouts, should the VO2 max rise pretty quickly, or is this a long-term type of an increase?
Well, to really get your VO2 max, you would go into a laboratory and they would actually measure the amount of oxygen going in and coming out and be able to get you your exact number. However, most of the time we just want to race faster. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily care if our VO2 max is higher or lower.
Yeah.
And a lot of the devices now do estimate VO2 max. You have to be careful with VO2 max because it's ultimately change over time that we care about. Watches will tell you my VO2 max is this one day and then it's lower the next day and it's higher the next day. And athletes begin to get confused. And it's like, well, that's just, that's estimating VO2 max. So don't get too caught up into the exact number each day. But what you would really like to see is across this month or 6 weeks, you'd like to see the number change from what you had in the beginning. So if you do one of these workouts and you have your watch and it says, okay, your VO2 max is, let's say it's 55. That'd be a common number somebody might see. And then by the time you finish 6 weeks where you did one of these heavy breathing workouts each week, and now you were at 58, you would say, okay, I have objective means that I've improved this aspect of my fitness. Now, it'll improve rather quickly, and then it kind of levels off. It doesn't. We have a ceiling that you can't just keep doing it forever without it kind of genetic potential.
VO2 max is interesting. There's a lot of numbers out there. Heart rate, we talked about earlier, VO2 max, etc. And if we were to use those objective findings just to determine who's going to win this race, we wouldn't have to show up and put bibs on. There's some other variables out there that regardless if the guy next to you or the gal next to you has a higher VO2 max, they may not be standing on the podium as that's their goal or objective. What do you think, Coach, is one of the most important things for a runner to be successful? Maybe it's not a high VO2 max number. Maybe it's just guts. Maybe it's just determination. a tangible you really can't put your hands around. What do you find your successful athletes have in common?
They're durable and they're disciplined. Mm. Those are the two things, because ultimately success in running is about work over time. And this is the hard part of the sport, right? Is that you just have to do it for a long time. Most people get interruptions in their training with injuries. So the more you can injury-proof your body, then you give yourself a chance to do more training and do a higher quality training over time. And then the second thing is they seem to maintain their motivation, and they're fairly disciplined in getting their running in. They don't have big breaks from running for other reasons. They tend to kind of get their running in. So those two things, I think, ultimately lead to an athlete being able to perform very well consistently over time. And it's the interruptions in either motivation or training usually due to injury that causes the problems. Because you're right, VO2 max is not the end-all be-all. In fact, they did a really cool study in the early 70s with all these very famous elite runners. And Frank Shorter had a VO2 max of 69, and Steve Prefontaine had a VO2 max of 84, but they ran basically the exact same 5K time. So it's kind of, Shorter was more efficient within his VO2 max, whereas Prefontaine sort of had this gigantic engine in his body. So it is a culmination of a lot of different factors, but I'm really working with athletes to say, how can we train in a way that is sustainable so that you can stack week after week after week? And if you take a break, it's because you're choosing to take a break as opposed to having an interruption in your training. That way we get to the starting line healthy. We usually get to the finish line a lot faster in those cases, and everybody has a much more enjoyable time.
You know, I'm glad you brought that comparison up between those two athletes, because my next question was going to be, I've noticed in some of the research I've done that women typically have a lower VO2 max than men, but I would assume that as a coach, you're looking at the trend line, like you talked about earlier, that you're looking at, are we doing the workouts that are causing that VO2 max to steadily increase until the plateau that you were talking about? Is that correct?
It is. And to be honest, the speed at the lactate threshold is the number one determinant of distance running success. So really, that's the number we're trying to see the biggest change in. And then running economy, which is sort of, you know, how much oxygen do you require at a given pace? If we can see the economy improve, and that's one of the things for us older runners, is our economy keeps getting better and better. Even if we can't quite hit that VO2 max anymore, we can get more economical in our running. And that's why you see some of these older runners, they just continue to perform so well, even if they can't do the same training that they did when they were younger, but they're just so much more efficient in the way that they utilize energy. And then, of course, they're smarter. They know how to distribute their effort better in races.
You know, when there is a break, whether that's a conscious break of I need some rest, or whether it's an injury caused blip in the training, how fast does that VO2 max drop? Does it drop as fast as it increases?
Well, it's hard to say for sure, because people are always still using their oxygen. And so depending on what you're doing during the break can affect it, as well as your training history. But for sure, if you had your watch and it was estimating and you have a couple of weeks of no running, you're not going to have the same VO2 max that you had before. Now, you can get it back fairly quickly. It's easier to get it back than get it the first time. So you can lose some of that. But again, that's just one piece of the pie. I just bring it up because I find in trail racing, I see far too many runners, when they start to breathe really heavy, they kind of back off a little bit. And I know if they had exposure to this type of training, they'd be able to push through that. And again, it's not the whole race, right? It's just periods of the race where you have this sort of really heavy breathing.
I think that's really important. I think sometimes we, as trail runners, think that we're sabotaging our training by getting into that heavy breathing
part of the exercise that we're thinking, you know, we want to really get our fat burning engine running. And if I go into that heavy breathing, that's going to sabotage that. So that's good news from a wise coach.
Yeah. Well, training has to have everything. It can't just be one component. All components are very important. So if you want a peak performance, you need to have a sprinkling of a little bit of everything.
Yeah, everything in moderation seems to always apply to everything that whatever we look at in life, including your dinner plate. Yeah. You know, and I can see myself doing, you said, you know, 2 to 5 different sessions or 2 to 5 minutes of getting out there and doing that. I could see picking a hill and doing some heavy breathing and then picking a flat spot for some leg turnover and do some heavy breathing there just to break it up, just to stay fresh and not like every time I'm going along this flat strip, I have to go fast. But I would break it up, I think, into some hill and some flat and some maybe in some downhill so I can work on that speed of and place foot placement. Yeah.
Yeah, and try to match your race course. What are you going to face on race day? That's a great way to get specifically ready for the event.
Yeah. What's the danger of doing just too much slogging? I know I've got into the habit of just not doing any leg turnover and just slogging away, and I feel like I become what I am, a slogger.
Well, you typically will have a much, much shorter stride. Yeah. It will be harder for you to get it longer, and the body will become very resistant when you try to go faster. And those are typically the things that we would say we're not interested in having as a runner. And so I think that's why having some variety in training is really important.
Yeah, there's times you want to get that leg turnover going when you're out there on the course and the trail gives it to you. Sorry, Scott.
Hey Coach, I was going to say, how long has McMillan Running been around, the coaching service?
I launched the website in 2002, so I guess 15 years now, 16 years.
What trends do you see in running? I mean, you deal with all sorts of runners from, you know, a 5K runner to a marathon distance runner to the trail and ultra running. What trends do you see in running?
I think kind of what we've seen from the data, which is, you know, the half marathon is really becoming a very popular road distance. A lot of people have sort of checked off the marathon list and they enjoy the training of the half a little bit better since they can kind of have a life and train for a half marathon. Whereas with the marathon, you kind of feel like you've got to sacrifice a lot. Certainly, we see a lot of movement toward other events, trails being a perfect example, ultra being a perfect example, obstacle, lots of different types of events for people to experience. So we see kind of a real dispersion in what people want to do. The sport is also really wide now. You know, the first running boom was a whole bunch of people that wanted to be Frank Shorter. Mm-hmm. And they were usually kind of in their 20s and 30s and trying to run really fast, right? And then we had the second running boom was the charity marathon group. And that's where we saw, you know, get to the finish line. And that's a huge accomplishment. But today, you have young people in these running crews that run at night and do all kinds of different runs than those of us who kind of came through the high school, college pro kind of running idea. And then you've got a lot of people picking up the sport to be healthier and then finding a love for it. And then they get into whatever their thing is, whether it's the dopey challenge or running, you know, a marathon in every state or every continent now. I mean, there's just so it's really wide as to the opportunities for running. And so you should be able to find something that kind of, you know, floats your boat.
Yeah, I think that's the variety out there is intriguing. You don't have to, you know, there's a lot of people that are doing their own thing rather than an organized race, which I think is also very fun.
Yeah.
You know, having a coach appears to be pretty important because even coaches have coaches. And we, you know, we talked to Sally McRae, who does some coaching, and she has a coach. And you know, you talk to Liza LaPierre, she has a coach. There's a lot of people that are accomplished and elite athletes that have their coach, and you would select them to be a coach. So what is it that a coach needs a coach?
Well, runners are crazy, and we don't often make the best decisions when we're in it. And that's kind of the runner's problem, right? Is that we get a little bit too deep in the woods and we're not able to clearly see the mistakes that we're making that are going to cause a problem in the future or maybe have already caused a problem. So that objective eye, somebody that's not quite as emotionally attached to the daily training log, can really help that person avoid problems. I spend my day reading training logs and I shake my head so much. In fact, last week I was just like, are you kidding me? How can you not read this same report and not see these errors that you're making? Any human would say that's a bad idea. That's going to result in a negative performance. And sure enough. So I just think that as we get into it, as we're emotionally attached, we're all goal driven. So if it's on that piece of paper, I'm going to do it. You know, we kind of have the mentality that can make us successful, but it also can, you know, be our undoing. And that's where an objective eye, it doesn't even have to be a coach. Just talk to your wife about your running and she'll say, you're an idiot. Why would you do that? That makes no sense. And you're like, well, you know, you're right. That doesn't make any sense. But I was too much in the weeds.
You know, I'm in a profession where they occasionally I get asked questions, what should I do about X or Y? And I turned it around. I said, what if I ask you the same question? What would you tell me? And they have the right answer every time.
That's right. That's right. It's amazing.
Hey, one of the other topics that, you know, when we were talking about this podcast that really intrigued me is how to be your best at all times. Explain what you meant by that. What I got from that is, boy, can you actually perform your best all the time? that intrigues me.
Yeah, it's a concept that came from the sports psychologist that I had to work with my pro team. I used to coach an Olympic development team here in Flagstaff, and I had a sports psychologist. And he talked about, could you run your best in a race in each segment of the race? Because each segment of the race is different, right? You're not always doing the same thing across a race. And so his thing was, okay, in the first third of the race, what should you be doing to be your best in that third? What about the second third? What about the third third? What about on this climb? What about if this person passes you? And what are you going to do? So it kind of wasn't like be your best all the time. It was sort of like, can you race your best in every segment of your race? And trail running is really the perfect kind of crucible for this, right? Because if you're on the track, it's all the same. You're just going around and around and it's just dealing with fatigue. But on the trails, you have so many opportunities where, okay, I'm doing this big climb. How can I be my best in this climb? What do I need to get the most out of myself in this climb? And then you might have a downhill after. Okay, what should I do to be my best in this downhill or the flats or this, you know, really technical section? So his concept was there's always room for us to be better when we race. And we all know that because when we finish, we invariably look back at the race and go, well, there's 10 places I could have improved, you know, 2 or 3 seconds, no problem. So his idea was go into a race with the objective that you were always going to be running your best. It doesn't mean your hardest, right? Because in the beginning of the race, that wouldn't be your hardest, but it would be what is appropriate to get the best from that segment of the race. So that's what that means.
Hey, Coach, I don't know even know if this is a question yet. And if it's not, then you really can't answer it. But we always hear, run your race. Don't run somebody else's race. And it kind of parallels with what you just stated is, you know, you run your best at all times. You know, don't run somebody else's race. How do you coach somebody or how have you coached yourself on pulling away emotionally from keeping up with the pack or allowing yourself to drift back and being okay with drifting back, realizing that's your strategy? Because that could be the undoing emotionally of a lot of runners and racers. How do you make it okay and give yourself permission to be you at all times?
Well, I think that's pre-planning. I think it's going into a race with a plan. You've looked at the race course, maybe you've even jogged the course. So you have an idea of what you need to be doing in each segment that's going to help you the most, right? Because so for me, I'm much better uphill than downhill. So if I look at a course, I'm going to be taking advantage of the uphills, and then I'm really going to have to work hard on the downhills, probably just to stay even, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to look at each course and come up with what your strategy is, and then you use everybody else in the race to help you. So in those segments where you need to, you know, push harder because you usually don't, like for me on a downhill, it's great if I use somebody else because they're typically faster than I am downhill. So I'm go for them, stay with them, do everything you can to stick with that person because that's going to help me get the most out of that segment of the race. Same thing, if somebody else starts to go crazy in a section that I know that pace is not going to be helpful, you just have to be disciplined and maybe have your strategy laid out. You know, we'll see that in Boston this year, right? Everybody will go gangbusters the first 10 miles and then they'll die later because of the course. So I think it's just about being disciplined and having your strategy and then using people within the race to get the most out of yourself.
Good, good. You know, some of the great, great runners, and they often finish on a podium, are the people that just sit back and run their own race. They don't let anybody disturb their plan. And I think going in there and running your race and running the plan is just really important.
Yeah, and don't do anything stupid. That's the thing. Most of us, we just, you know, we run a pace that is inappropriate, and you need to pace better, and then you'll race better. And so having that discipline and control and a great race strategy, I think, is very helpful.
I like the tip that you gave, and I made a note to myself to break the race, or you could even take this into a training run, but to break the race into segments and mm-hmm. and consciously have a plan for each of those segments. And going back to what you said, that most people go out too fast at a race. You know, maybe take the first 10 miles and say, at this, this is my best race for that first 10 miles and segment that out. I really like that philosophy. That's great stuff.
Well, and what I've found is that the pros think differently. They think that way. They think with much more of a strategy for how they're going to execute the race. Most of us, we go into it wishing we're going to feel like $1 million and be able to run a certain pace. But, you know, that's wishful thinking. You're better off having a solid plan, knowing exactly what you're going to do, and then go out and execute each segment. And if you just stack those segments together, right, it should lead to a great performance.
You know, that reminded me of one of the greatest performances that I saw during the Olympics recently was the mass start speed skating with the women. I don't know if you saw that, but one of the women went out blistering fast, and she had almost a full lap on the entire pack for the first, I don't know, 10 or 15 laps. And everybody stayed so calm because they were racing their race. They knew this person that was took off had no reason to podium or even to finish in the top 10. And they just let her go out. And then they just raced their race, and they broke their race up into those sections. And when there was five laps left, everybody passed her. And anyway, thank you. That's really good, helpful information.
You know, the truth be told, the coach has actually coached us on this podcast because he sent over a couple of ideas for us. And I think this next one that you brought up fits perfectly into this conversation. Maybe you've steered us this way on purpose. But is your personality a blessing or a curse? And what are your thoughts on that, Coach?
Mine's usually a curse. I'm usually trying to make up for things.
Well, what's interesting in running, and I've been really lucky to work with a lot of different types of runners, lots of personality types. And what you start to find is the ones that can leverage their personality traits for good, they're the ones that really succeed. It's the ones that their personality types really get in the way. Those are the ones that often fail. And you have to accept your personality, right? And you can go back to the 1950s where they kind of came up with the type A and type B. I don't think psychologists really use that anymore, but it stuck around for sure. So we know type A being, boy, I'm really driven, I'm competitive, I'm disciplined, I get the job done. You know, all of those really positive traits that can lead to a great performance. They are also impatient. They're stubborn. They don't listen. So these are other traits that, you know, can be their undoing. And type B be the other way, right? This is a person that's much more relaxed, go with the flow, don't worry too much about things. Those can be really positives too in running, right? Because you can't get worked up over everything. So, you know, having a relaxed attitude can be good. However, that can also be you don't get the work in. You're not competitive enough. You maybe give up too easily on yourself. And so in my work with runners, I found it very interesting, even at the elite level, to see this dichotomy between personality traits. And me as a coach, I'm trying to figure out, okay, this person is really a type A. So what do I need to do to help that person leverage the good qualities of type A, but not destroy themselves with the bad qualities? And the same with a type B, where, hey, that's good. We can leverage that for success, but yet avoid some of the issues that can come out, you know, that might be a negative of that personality trait. So I've been talking to runners a lot lately about trying to recognize your traits, your habits, your tendencies, and which ones of those are good and when could they be a problem. So a good example would be a type A runner, which is a lot of runners are kind of type A. You would want as a coach to pre-plan like a down week, right? So maybe every fourth week you'd plan a down week. Because if you don't, that type A runner might run themselves into the ground. They're just so driven. So you go ahead and you put it in preemptively to kind of overcome. You also might know, and I coached this one woman, she was world championship type caliber. She went to the world championships in the marathon. But I had to give her fartlek training early in her program because she was so connected to her time she ran before that early in the season, she'd be mad if she couldn't hit the time she was hitting at the end of the season before. And I was like, well, this doesn't make any sense. You shouldn't be able to hit those times. But to her, that was her mentality. It was that she was so competitive numbers-wise. So I had to do everything by effort early on until we knew that her performance level was such that she could hit those times. So just a couple of examples of where you can look at your personality traits and start to identify, all right, what's good, but when can it be bad? And what can I preemptively do in my training or in my training with my training partners or my coach or my family so that I don't get myself into a situation that's a negative?
I think that helps explain or answer one of the earlier questions. Why do you need a coach? I think that really, you know, for a coach to sit back and help a runner analyze what type of personality they are and then help skew their training to maximize the positives of their personality. Do you feel that there are more type A successful runners than type B?
I would say that there's definitely more type A runners. I think you can be successful with both types of personality. I've had athletes go to world championships that are the opposite personality types. So it's not one versus the other, for sure. But it's just a matter of accepting, you know, what is that athlete like, and then how do you need to manipulate the training so that it can always keep them in the right mindset to leverage their talents. So, I mean, you got to be disciplined. You got to, you know, have a lot of those type A things. But I've seen a ton of type A runners just run themselves into the ground, and they never will ultimately fulfill their potential because they're their own worst enemy. And, you know, as a coach, you got to really be clever in how you can manipulate the training so that you keep them, you know, in the right zone mentally, and you never let them sort of get out of control and, you know, start moving in a direction that is a negative.
So I hear, and I imagine this answer, it really depends on the personality of your runner. But are there times that you say, just take your watch off, take it off, leave it at home, don't even look at the time that you start the run, and just go out and just have fun?
Yeah, type A runners for sure need a lot of that, because we have so much data on our wrists now that they can analyze every step always. And so sometimes you do have to say, hey, just go chill out and just go for a run and remember why you enjoy just going for a run. But you got to set them up for that, because that's a big step for somebody.
Yeah.
They're pretty, you know, they like the numbers. It's going to be very difficult for them not to sort of be stuck with the watch. And so again, that kind of comes back to, I think runners should kind of recognize in themselves the positives and negatives, so they can preemptively, you know, kind of sprinkle things in to make sure that they do, okay, this is a no watch run, or I'm going to wear it, but I'm not going to look at it, right? I'm going to turn off the, you know, the beeps and the buzzes and all of that, and I'll just look at the data later will be important.
Yeah. Do you find that that different personalities can actually be training partners successfully?
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes they can drive each other mad because, you know, they're oil and water, but they can help each other a lot, right? So I've had type A marathoners who were really, it was important for them to be around a type B marathoner, because they would kind of relax a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. They would see this other runner who was equally successful and realize, oh, I can, you know, relax. I can have a cheeseburger. I can, you know, just not be so wound up all the time. And then it goes the other way as well. The type B marathoner, who might have a tendency maybe not to be as competitive with himself or herself, they need to be around that type A runner so that they can see, okay, I love the competitiveness in this athlete. That's something that I want to mimic. So it's kind of nice if you have a mix. They have to be able to tolerate each other's idiosyncrasies, but that's part of being in a group.
Hey, if people are listening and they're thinking, you know, maybe I do need a coach, what kind of coaching packages should someone look for? Are you constantly checking in? Are there you know, intense programs and some programs that just give you some guidance? What should a person look for or can expect?
Well, they might want to consider what they feel like they need. Mm-hmm. Some people just need, give me a training plan to follow. Yeah. I just want to use your philosophy. Give me the plan and I'm off and running and I'll be good. I can make the adjustments. And then you have people at the other end of the spectrum, which are, I need you to be on me all the time. I want you to evaluate every day. I want to be able to call and text you. I want to be able to talk to you on the via Skype. I want you to analyze every one of my races coming up, all of that. So, you know, there are programs available. Certainly McMillan Running has them, but I think most platforms now have sort of low touch all the way up to super high touch. Most people do best sort of in the middle, where you've got a training plan and coaching access. My McMillan Run Team is that way. So you get your training plans and you have access to me for your coaching questions. But obviously it's not personal online coaching. I'm not going to be evaluating every run that you do like I do with my personal coaching athletes. And of course the pricing is different, reflective of that engagement.
Is the old theory still true that maybe, 20% require 80% of the work? talk about your high touch, or maybe in the middle of the run, they stop and give you a call and talk to you a bit. Have you had those coaches?
One of the things that's fun is that we are all passionate about running.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. And it is very personal to us.
Yes.
And for many of us, it has been life-changing. It would be difficult for us to imagine our life without running in it. So I certainly understand and appreciate when people are really into it, because that's kind of the same process that I went through as well. And it's kind of fun to live with that person through the process of kind of discovering that they're a runner, exploring their potentials, having different experiences and the pros and the cons and the highs and the lows. It's a lot of fun for me.
I've got to imagine there's probably as much pride of putting somebody on top of a podium as getting someone to finish as a coach, maybe even more at the back of the pack, just making it in with seconds to remain, maybe as inspirational as a coach as a podium finish.
Yeah, I think it ultimately comes down to what were the challenges that the athlete faced and that they overcame. And so that can be a lot of different things, right? And so for me, the greatest reward is when we've had to struggle and we've had issues that we've been able to overcome, and that person has gone on to achieve their goal. That could be just getting out the door twice a week for a month. It could be, you know, qualifying for the Olympic Games. So it's the, you know, where they are in the pack or on the podium is somewhat less important than what did they go through to get where they were. And you see, you know, because you get to share with them the challenges. Right now, you know, it's winter in a lot of places, so we're having to adjust a lot of training. And you realize, man, that guy just went out and did a tempo run in that. That's incredible. And so you have a real appreciation for that struggle.
Yeah, yeah. Your last bullet point that you put on there was leg speed, dancing along the trails. And I really liked that visual, dancing on the trail.
Yeah.
What were you thinking when you wrote that, Coach?
Well, I race a lot on the trails, and a lot of trails get technical, and they're not all smooth, and they haven't removed all the rocks and the roots for us. So you need to be light on your feet. And I think a lot of people can do a lot better in trail racing if they think light on their feet and they put themselves in situations to practice that as well. Again, kind of going back to if you race a lot on the trails, you'll see sections where people just slow down so much because they just don't know how to deal with obstacles in their way. And if they get more comfortable with being light on their feet, dancing, I just think dancing is the perfect word for it, where you're in a technical section and you're dancing along. It's less running than it is just, where's this foot need to go so that it can land and I can push off, and then where's the next one going? And that's a really great mindset, but you have to practice it. Again, go onto the trails, find a section, run quickly through it, get better and better at figuring out how to dance along the trails.
Yeah, as you were saying that, I was thinking of touching the foot, you know, touching and touching the next foot, not planting or landing, but just, you know, touch and go, touch and go, touch and go, and not spending a lot of time in any one spot.
Yeah, and think about roots and rocks and those sorts of terrain where you're often doing that, where you are definitely, you know, dancing, and it is just touch this foot very quickly and move on to the next one.
I remember the old, we had Scott Jurek on it one time, and he said, run like water flows, you know.
There you go.
That was a great analogy.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've asked this to many guests. What's your opinion as a coach on putting some earbuds in and listening to some good music while you're running and dancing to that music?
Well, whatever works for you. Yeah, whatever works for you. Doesn't matter to me. I personally never listen to music while I run because that's my time to be in my own head. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, podcasts and listening to music is what they want to do. It's personal preference.
Okay. Just got one in the plus column for me, Coach. That's good. Because I like to listen when I run.
You know, we're going to link. We've actually had two different podcasts with Coach McMillan in the past, and the latest one we did revolved around one of his books. And so if you haven't read any of Coach McMillan's books, one of them is You Only Faster. That's a catchy title. That's a great title. But we did a podcast revolving around another book called Marathon Freakout. And it was,
oh yeah,
how do you overcome that race day freakout? And I'd actually forgotten about that podcast. I'll link it to the show notes. But I need to go back and re-listen to that. Because I remember that was a really good, really good tips in that book.
Yeah, that's a good one. I wrote that basically because every marathon season, people start freaking out like crazy. And I was like, hang on, we got this. Here are the things we need to do. Here's some, you know, step-by-step over the last couple of weeks of things that you can take care of to make your race day easier. And it seems to calm people down, seems to keep them from kind of getting a little bit too crazy mentally during that tapering period before the race. And then they can go into the race with a great strategy and a plan, and then you just have to execute your plan. The problem is worry, right? It's fear and worry and can I and will I? And so the more that you can have a plan, I think it helps overcome that.
You know, we talk a lot about running, and you've got to, you know, run some hills and do some speed work and, you know, plant lightly and go as the water goes and all these things about running. But what about coaching off the trail or off the track? Sleep and diet and just body work, maybe at a massage therapist or just something. There are other things that make a whole person when it comes to running. What are your thoughts on some of that?
Yeah, we do a lot of that. We call it prehab training. So yeah. It's designed to injury-proof you before. Been really lucky. You know, the average rate is 60 to 80% in runners. We've been able to get runners using our plan down to 9%. So wow. It's been a significant reduction in injuries. I think that comes from smart training, doing the prehab work. You don't have to do a ton of it, but if you do a little bit, over time, you can really, injury-proof your body. And then really empowering the runners to make smart decisions so they can adjust the program as they go. Because, you know, life is never consistent, so you need to feel empowered and understand how to modify your training as you go.
Those numbers are pretty telling. 68 to 80% injury, I think what you said, and you're down to 9%. People that just make good decisions and they're aware of their body and they have somebody to bounce it off of and not let them go down the path too far to injury. Catching something early in a sport that's just a repetitive type motion sport, you get plenty of clues that, hey, something's going south here. There are things to pick up on, and 68 to 80% of the people are missing it. And I think that's good observation.
Hey, Coach, I have a question for you. Have you ever fired an athlete maybe their personality, they couldn't figure out how to balance the strengths of their personality, and you've just said, you know what,
they didn't listen.
Yeah, you're wasting money here.
Yeah, I just did that a couple of weeks ago. Sometimes it's not a good fit and it's not going to work. And maybe there are expectations that, are just not in line with reality. And, for me, I'm happy to work through lots of challenges. But if somebody's not going to listen or they're going to do things that are counter to their stated running goals, then mm-hmm. I'm probably not the best person to work with. They'd be better off finding a better fit. There's no reason to try to force it. You're better off just parting ways and finding a better fit for sure. Some people will never be happy no matter what, it seems. So yeah. You have mm-hmm. to accept that as just part of when you work with people. But it doesn't happen very often, but I think for runners, you got to find the right personality in your coach who's going to work with you in a way that kind of fits your expectation and what you need, and make sure that those needs are realistic, reasonable, and then you'll probably have a successful relationship.
But I was going to say, your staff that you have at McMillan Running is quite diverse. How does one pick? Does someone get on McMillan Running and pick a coach? They read their bio and say, this is the coach I think works for me, or do they go to you and you have an interview and then you say, you know, I think you're going to work best with this coach over here? How does that whole thing work?
Yeah, it's more the latter. So once a person signs up for personal coaching, they fill out an extensive questionnaire. Okay. That sort of gives us the background on the athlete: training, racing history, life, goals, all that kind of stuff. Then I review that and figure out what's the best coaching situation for that athlete. Mm-hmm. So, we have some really good women coaches. And so, you know, certainly there's certain people that would be a better fit for them. We have ultra coaches. We have more track coaches. We have different sort of specialties, if you will. So I look at which coach am I going to partner with to help that athlete. And that's really, you know, comes down to me looking at the questionnaire. Certainly someone could request a coach. That's not a problem. But for the most part, I'm doing an evaluation of who do I think is going to be the best fit for this athlete given their goals.
I think that's a good differentiator because, you know, if I'm sitting here thinking, you know what, I need a coach, I would say, how do I know whether this coach is going to work for me or not? And so for you to have a team of coaches that you can then match, I think is a really good model that you have there.
Yeah, it's been good.
Well, Scott, I think we've got some coaching work to do. We got to get some assignment from our coach here. Get out there and do some turnover and breathe heavy and breathe hard.
I think I need to figure out how I can double my VO2 max. I looked at some of the VO2 maxes of some pretty famous runners and endurance athletes, and I'm well less than half of that. So we need you've motivated me, Coach.
Good. You might need to pick different parents too, but that'll be a bit more challenging.
Hey, you know what? It comes down to we're supposed to enjoy this sport, you know, and that's yeah. That's what it's about, you know, being happy with the running and getting out there and just enjoying the community and the social aspect and life is better when you train, you know, regardless of how fast you are in the middle or the end. Life's just better when you're active and your muscles feel good when you use them and you sleep better and I think you think better. So it doesn't matter where you are as long as you're doing it.
So instead of focusing on VO2 max, I need to focus about dancing on the trails.
Dancing
and smiling.
And touch and go. Hey, Coach, thank you so much for joining us again on the podcast. We consider you a fantastic resource. We're glad that people know about McMillan Running I enjoy your tweets as they go out. That's what prompted this podcast. You had so many great things were coming out. Like, I've got to talk to him about this stuff. This is good. It's better than 140 characters. We need to get deeper into this thing. So thanks for putting those out there.
It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. Now go out and run. Mas.